you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. What a great time we had last night covering election returns here on LAist. There's nothing quite like election night. And of course, we had live NPR coverage with Nick Roman starting at 5 yesterday. And then from 8 to 10 o'clock last night, Frank Stoltz, our civics and democracy correspondent, and Jill Replogle, Orange County correspondent, joining me with all the returns. And we're going to continue with analysis and returns throughout the majority of today's program. And late in the second hour, we'll take a little break and have some fun and move off of politics. But for the first 90 minutes, our focus is completely on yesterday's big election news. And we begin with news that was even made this morning, national news. And with us to talk about it from NPR, senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, good morning.
Good to be with you, Larry.
There was speculation whether Nikki Haley, if the Republican was trounced in Super Tuesday, whether she'd suspend her campaign. We got that news this morning. Ron, your thoughts about Nikki Haley dropping out of the race, suspending, as opposed to just trying to hang on in case something happens to Trump?
Interesting choice of words. She said that she was suspending her campaign, not ending it, that Donald Trump would in all likelihood be the nominee of the Republican Party, and that she would support him as she would support any American president. She did not endorse him. She did not say she was repenting all the things she has said about him, how she didn't know whether or not he would follow the Constitution if he were in office again. All of that is still out there, and perhaps at some point, before we get to Milwaukee in July, she will, in fact, endorse him. Ted Cruz held out in 2016, didn't endorse Trump as the runner-up back in that particular first go-around for Trump, didn't endorse him until late September. So there's the possibility that Nikki Haley comes aboard at some juncture after she's negotiated whatever it is she thinks she might be able to negotiate with Trump.
The difference, though, seems to be that Ted Cruz hasn't had a difficult time aligning himself with Trump's views. For Nikki Haley, she's run, you know, with a pretty wide difference on issues from the former president. And so, I mean, would that do damage to what she represents if she ultimately did endorse him?
It would seem that if she ultimately endorses him, she stands for little other than wanting to be a Republican nominee for something in the future. It would seem that she stood for little other than the delight, I suppose, whatever you want to call it, of being the last person standing running against Donald Trump or beating out all those men who were on stage with her last summer and fall when the Republicans were still having debates about the presidential nomination. Trump, of course, never participated in any of those. And so what does she stand for? I think we're going to find out in the weeks and months ahead. And it's possible that what she's really thinking here is that if the Republican Party is trying to pick up the pieces 4 years from now and nominate someone other than Donald Trump, surely, but perhaps somebody who might be different and not just a copy of Donald Trump, that she would be in position to be that person.
We're talking with Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent for NPR. We also got news this morning that Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, who's leaving that position, has endorsed Trump. And my understanding is that the two men haven't spoken in years, that there's a great deal of antipathy between them. So what's the thought process of McConnell endorsing?
This is complicated and is largely in the mind of Mitch McConnell, but he is at this moment still the Republican leader in the Senate. And the overwhelming majority of people in the Senate, in his party, are going to want Donald Trump to be elected in the fall. Probably even Mitch McConnell, in his ambivalence about Donald Trump, doesn't really want a Democratic administration, especially if that would mean a House and Senate in Democratic hands. Mitch McConnell's great dream is that the Republicans take back control of the Senate, and in his final year as the leader of that party in that chamber. But this is awfully difficult for him because, as you say, they haven't spoken since January 6, 2021. On that occasion, Mitch McConnell blamed Trump for the insurrection on January 6th. He said that he had gathered the crowd, he had incited the crowd, he had done everything that made January 6th what it was and what a threat to the normal order of elections it was. So they're totally estranged on a personal level. But still, the imperative for Mitch McConnell is to remain the leader, at least for the rest of this year, of the Senate Republicans. And this is where they are, and he probably needs to do this just to remain as their leader.
Ron, what does this mean for the states holding primaries from here on out? A third of the delegates were up for yesterday's Super Tuesday, and with the presidential primaries decided, I just wonder, is anybody going to turn out in the races to come? We had low turnout here in California with it being a foregone conclusion that Biden and Trump would win their respective primaries. What are we going to see elsewhere?
People don't go through a lot of bad weather or a lot of inconvenience to vote for foregone conclusions. So it's going to have to be down ballot races that bring people out, as of course was the case in California as well. Lots of interesting down ballot races. And so people will come out who care enough about politics and about exercising their franchise as voters. But it's got to be admitted that the headline and the driving force in these kinds of cycles, a presidential cycle, is a sense that you're making a difference in the presidential election. And it's too late because that was all kind of decided, in a sense, months ago. But Joe Biden never really got a major league opponent. Imagine the embarrassment of Dean Phillips, who is a congressman from Minnesota, running against Joe Biden. He lost his home state. In fact, he finished third in his home state behind Joe Biden and uncommitted. So, you know, Dean Phillips was never a factor. Marianne Williamson was never a factor. So Joe Biden was essentially unopposed, not unusual for an incumbent president. On the Republican side, there was a flock of candidates a year ago, but they all fell by the wayside because none of them could replace Trump in the hearts of the most dedicated, devoted Republican voters. And those people have been enough for Trump and throughout the primaries, and we're going to see whether or not they're going to be enough for Trump in the fall, because we're seeing substantial fractions, of course, but nonetheless, meaningful fractions of the Republican electorate saying, yeah, I came out for the primaries for Haley or for somebody else, and I don't think I'm all that excited about voting for Trump in the fall. I'm keeping my powder dry.
I guess we're a long way from Ted Kennedy challenging Jimmy Carter in an intra-party fight in a primary.
Yeah, that was 1980, and that was a totally different animal, and it divided the party for many years. I mean, in Washington for years after that, decades really after that, people would let you know whether they had been with Kennedy or Carter in 1980.
Wow. It was a deep part of identity.
Yes, it became part of identity.
Well, we're talking with Ron Elving, senior Washington editor and correspondent for NPR. So, Ron, before I let you go, what are we looking at in November? I know we're way in advance, but the potential for flipping of either house to the other party.
The House people have seen as being pretty likely to slide back to the Democrats, largely because of mapping changes, gerrymandering being brought under control in some states. That could make a difference. Also, the Supreme Court has weighed in on a couple of racial gerrymanders, and that could help the Democrats. Ought to get them at least one seat in Alabama and perhaps other seats. But that's a mixed bag. It's very hard to predict on the basis of just mapping. And I think in the end, it'll depend on who has the energy on the presidential side. If the Democrats are winning there, they'll win the House, and vice versa. If the Republicans are carrying the day on the presidential ticket, that will probably mean a Republican House going forward. Now, how many seats either party is likely to have as a margin is going to be minimal, because there are only about 20 or 25 seats, maybe 30, that are considered competitive. And even if they go heavily one way or the other, it'll be a slim margin in the House. The Senate is anybody's call. The Democrats have twice as many seats to defend. The Republicans have a lot of seats that aren't on the ballot this fall. So right there, the odds are that you can't lose what's not at risk. So the Republicans should hold their own at the least and probably pick up a couple of Democratic seats and get into the majority again.
All right. And of course, last night we learned that the matchup for the late Dianne Feinstein Senate seat will pit Congressmember Adam Schiff, who got 33% of the vote, against former Dodger star Steve Garvey, Republican, with 32%. They'll face off in November. Congressmembers Katie Porter and Barbara Lee had 14 and 7%, respectively. Again, we're a long way from the final count, but it's Schiff versus Garvey in November in a safely Democratic seat. In the House 40th Congressional District, this is the seat that Adam Schiff had represented, centered on Burbank. Laura Friedman, state legislator, with 27%, the Democrat, Republican Alex Balikian with 21%, followed by longtime state legislator Anthony Portantino's 14%, and former L.A. City Attorney Mike Feuer with 13%. So it's looking like Friedman and Balikian will face off in the 40th to succeed Adam Schiff, that a safely Democratic district. And in the 47th district, Republican Scott Baugh was the top vote getter with 33% as of the current count. Baugh, longtime GOP fixture in Orange County, the former head of the county Republican Party. This is the seat that Katie Porter had represented, coastal Orange County. Dave Min, the Democratic state legislator, followed with 25%. Democrat Joanna Weiss, well back with 19%. So it appears Baugh and Min will face off for the 47th district. I don't know, Ron, whether is the thought that district is a toss-up, or is that thought that given the registration, Democrats will likely keep it?
It's still a toss-up because registration is not a magic wand. We don't know what turnout will be like in the country in November. We don't know what it'll be like in California, much less knowing in one particular congressional district. So if you go back a few decades, Orange County was solid Republican. Then we saw an extraordinary switch in the recent years where during the Obama years, Orange County became increasingly Democratic. And now it's really one of the great jump balls of all of America's congressional map. What happens in Orange County could very well determine who is the majority party in the House.
All right. We'll keep a close watch on that and cover these races. Thank you, Ron. Good to have you with us, as always. We sure appreciate it.
The pleasure is all mine. Thank you, Larry.
Thanks. Ron Elving, NPR, senior Washington editor and correspondent. Let's look at some of the local results here in Los Angeles County in the DA's race. It looks like George Gascón, the incumbent DA, is going to be facing challenger Nathan Hochman, who had run for state attorney general as a Republican. He had lost in that race. He's now no party preference. He got 18%. Jonathan Hatami was third in the current vote with 13%. So Gascón and Hochman look like they're going to face off. Our civics and democracy correspondent Frank Stoltz with us. This is going to be a fascinating race, Frank. And you think this is going to shatter the spending barrier for an L.A. County DA race?
Well, Hochman raised $2 million, more than twice any other candidate in this race. So he is a proven fundraiser. Plus, we're going to see a lot of outside money in this race. This is going to be watched nationally as a referendum on criminal justice reforms. We know that the DA, George Gascón, has been a leader in that arena. He's dramatically changed this office. He is not a great fundraiser, but he will rely a lot on criminal justice reform advocates from around the country coming in, as they did in 2020, to help him get elected in the first place.
And he wasn't the only one. There's sort of a funding network that was working to elect reform-minded DAs in cities all across the country, Gascón being just one of those.
And this will be a stark choice because Hochman has said he will reverse all of Gascón's policies. So it'll be a clear question: do you support these reforms that Gascón has implemented, or don't you?
On the county supervisorial race, we had some prominent challengers to a couple of the supervisorial districts. First of all, in the second, Holly Mitchell was 65% at this point, and she just didn't even have to turn her head. She just ran straight to the finish line. Janice Hahn, who was facing a couple of challengers with some some degree of support still with 55%. If that holds, she will avoid a runoff in November against former L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva,
who got something like a third of the vote. So he still resonates with some voters. His maverick ways, his bashing of the County Board of Supervisors. But yeah, it looks like all three of these incumbent supervisors, Holly Mitchell, Janice Hahn, and Catherine Barger, will be reelected. These supervisor seats, once you get in there, you're usually there for all three terms. Very hard to unseat an incumbent county supervisor. Much harder than, for instance, a member of the city council.
Catherine Barger in that 5th district, which is San Gabriel Valley in the north and the high desert area, with 60%. And she was facing a challenge to her left, where Chris Holden, the longtime state legislator with a significant Pasadena base, was really, you know, trying to run as a more progressive candidate. But interestingly, Barger got a lot of labor support.
Yeah, she's a little bit of a rare breed now as a moderate Republican who, as you, I think, mentioned earlier, got both the support of, for instance, the sheriff's union, the deputies union, as well as Planned Parenthood. So she got a support from a wide array of organizations from both the left and the right.
Frank Stoltz joining us, civics and democracy correspondent. We're talking about the Los Angeles county races. When we come back, we'll talk with Frank about the L.A. city results. And we'll also be talking with our Jill Rep local Orange County correspondent about the supervisorial races there, some very high profile charter amendments in the city of Huntington Beach, a couple of candidates facing recall in the Orange Unified School District. We'll hear from Jill coming up a little bit later. And later this hour, we open up the phones to hear from you what you think of the top two primary system here in California. We've had years of operating under it. Do you like it, or would you like to see some degree of modification? We'll take your recommendations on that and hear you weigh in coming up later this hour. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's ongoing election coverage on LAist 89.3, but I want to remind you, you don't have to wait to hear Frank Stoltz and me or Jill Replogle talking about this anytime you want it, including the middle of the night. You can go to LAist.com/results and do your own analysis, looking at all the up-to-date results from the state of California and from Los Angeles and Orange counties. We're talking with Frank about Los Angeles city results now. First, there was one municipal measure on the ballot, Measure HLA, which would have mandated for any street repair of an eighth of a mile or more that the city's mobility plan be built out for that portion that was getting repaving. And it's doing extremely well with the current return, 63% support, Frank.
Boy, it's a huge victory for progressives. It's a huge victory for grassroots organizing. This was a citizen initiative. It was placed on the ballot by signatures, not by the city council. And it's going to have a big impact over the next 10 years because it's going to require the city of L.A. to build hundreds and hundreds of bike lanes and bus lanes and traffic calming measures to slow traffic down on many, many streets in Los Angeles. The whole idea, of course, is to make the streets safer. We know that there have been more traffic deaths and homicides in the past year in L.A. These traffic violence deaths have been going up over the last few years, despite, you know, Vision Zero, which was a declaration 5 years ago that we would be at zero deaths. And so this is a measure that's really going to change the streets. And it's also going to have a big impact on the budget. The city administrative officer has said this work that's going to be required under Measure HLA is going to cost over $3 billion, and that could take away from other programs in the city budget.
The proponents say that that's overstated because of things that were included in that analysis that wouldn't have to be part. But I'm just thinking, you know, how often is it that you get a budget analysis that comes in lower than what the actual cost is? I can't remember. So we'll have to see what happens. But the proponents of HLA have said that that analysis this was nonsense, essentially. Let's take a look at the city council races. And in the second district, the matchup in November is going to include Adrian Nazarian, but it's not quite clear yet with the votes that are in whether Sam Kabushian or Jillian Burgos are going to be the ones to face Nazarian here, because pretty tight between the number two and number three candidate in that race.
About 500 votes here between Kabushian and Burgos. Adrian Nazarian, not a surprise that he's finishing first here. He far outspent the other candidates, and he was endorsed by the incumbent, Paul Krikorian. This is his seat, and he's termed out.
All right. In the 4th District, Nithya Raman, completing her first term in office, and now with a district that has changed its boundaries. She has part of the San Fernando Valley that she did not have before. Raman will be facing off with Ethan Weaver. Raman standing at 45% currently, Weaver at 43%. This is, again, like the DA's race, expected to get a lot of spending come November.
Huge spending. There was already huge spending in the primary. More than $1 million against Raman and for Weaver. The players included the LA Police Protective League, the police union, the firefighters union, spending big to unseat Raman, who they see as too progressive. Of course, Nithya Raman was the original progressive, if you want to call her that, who was elected in the first wave of progressives in 2020 to the city council. And so this is going to be really a referendum on many of those progressive policies, like tenants' rights, eviction policies, homeless encampment policies.
Yeah, and I'm just this is something we expect to have some national spending too, which is because that does, it seems weird, but that does sometimes come into these local races.
I think it could. And Ethan Weaver, of course, a deputy city attorney who's considered sort of a more law and law order candidate here. Interestingly, Lev Baronian, the third candidate in this race, polled at 12.64%. And so more than half of the voters voted against Nithya Raman. So she faces an uphill battle here.
All right. Again, looking at the city of Los Angeles and the different races that we have going on in the 6th District, Imelda Padilla cruising to victory with more than 76%. She's reelected, as is Marquise Harris-Dawson. He's got 79%, so he's barely tested in his race. He doesn't have to face anyone in November. Heather Hutt, who was appointed to serve the 10th District, which sort of southwest L.A. area, I guess you'd say, she had 37% as of the current count. Grace Yu with 28%. They're going to face off. That'll be an interesting race.
Really interesting race. Heather Hutt appointed, of course, to replace Mark Ridley Thomas, who was convicted of corruption and sentenced to federal prison. So she's never really faced the voters. This was her first time. And Grace Yu has run for this seat this is her third time, two previous times. She is the former head of the Korean American Association, and she has turned out very well in this race, in part because, as you mentioned, this district includes Southwest LA, which is Leimert Park, but also Mid-Wilshire, and crucially for you, Koreatown. So this is going to be a hard-fought race. Heather Hutt,
really,
of course, African-American. And this has traditionally been a black seat on the LA City Council. So while she's finishing 10 percentage points ahead of you, I think it's going to be a tight race.
Well, and it's been fascinating because we've had a larger number of African-American elected officials in Los Angeles than the population numbers would necessarily indicate, because African-Americans are very high propensity voters compared to Latinos. So there's been a lag in Latino representation compared to population. And then when you factor in growing Asian American communities like the Korean American community, that makes this all the more interesting, seeing how demographic shifts and shifts in the demographics of registered voters and high propensity voters, how that all factors in. I geek out on this stuff. I find it so interesting.
Well, and I think there was sort of an agreement that there would be these three seats on the LA City Council that generally were quote unquote black seats, that they, that Latinos, that other racial groups would not challenge people in a big way, at least historically. That's changed over the last few years. And this 10th district really is now a competitive district. It's not considered necessarily a safe black seat anymore.
Heather Hutt Grace, you will go head to head in November. John Lee cruised to victory in the Northwest San Fernando Valley's 12th district, and in the 14th, where embattled Kevin De Leon is facing a huge cast of challengers. De Leon appears that he will move to the runoff in November, likely against Miguel Santiago, although Isabel Jurado is also just a bit behind Santiago, so that's still a very close race, but as it stands now, it would be De Leon and Santiago there.
Jurado just 250 votes behind Santiago in this very, very low turnout vote area. And Jurado, really an amazing story. She's a tenants' rights attorney. She's a progressive. She had a grassroots campaign. She was outspent by Santiago and his supporters by something like 3 or 4 to 1. And yet here she is in this grassroots campaign, just 250 votes behind him. If she were to come in second here, that would be a big story. And it would really set up an interesting contest with De Leon, because he would, of course, paint her as too progressive for the city council. But she is a devout progressive and by her own admission, and says she wants to add to the growing number of progressives on the LA City Council.
And we just have to say, with Kevin De Leon just 27% of the vote standing now, his battle is so uphill in November. He's definitely going to be the underdog when an incumbent comes up with just over a quarter of the vote.
And he did not raise a lot of money, and there was no outside money backing him. Of course, De Leon won. One of the most powerful people in the state, the leader of the state Senate. He ran for U.S. Senate. He ran for mayor. He's been around for a long time. And because of those secret tapes where he was in a conversation with racist and derogatory remarks, he is deeply wounded.
All right. Well, let's move to Orange County with Jill Replogle, our Orange County correspondent. Jill, share with us what we saw in the Orange County Board of Supervisors races.
Yeah. And so not much change from last night. Right now in the first district. Sorry, I just got to scroll down here and find my notes this. So Janet Wynn is ahead by quite a bit right now. She has a wide lead, about 45%. Behind her is Cypress City Council member Francis Marquez with 25%. So this is a district that Andrew Doe has led for a long time. He is termed out. He's been caught up in ethical questions recently, funneling millions in county funds to a nonprofit headed by his daughter. You know, this has been uncovered and reported extensively by our own Nick Gerda. And his chief of staff, Van Tran, had hoped to take over from Doe. Right now, he is trailing with 18%.
So that looks like it'll go to a November runoff at this point, and that Janet Wynn is pretty safely one of the two there. And Don Wagner, I assume he got more than 50%, the incumbent in the other other seat that's up.
Yeah, he is at 66% right now. So that seems like a pretty safe bet for him. I do want to note, and I mean, we've been talking about this, you know, since last night, but there are so many ballots still left to be counted in, you know, all of these races. So the registrar of voters in Orange County puts up a tally of how many votes it has left to count, which I finally found this morning. And, you know, they still have 200,000 ballots left to count. They have counted 400,000. So, you know, right there, that's at least a third of the ballots. And that number will expand as ballots trickle in through the mail in the coming days.
Yeah, very, very good point. Important to keep in mind. Although in these larger fields, it can be very difficult for someone, say, in third place to be able to make up that ground to pass one of the two people in front of them, just because of how dispersed those votes get.
Right.
We also have the recall effort against two members of the Orange Unified School District, two conservatives on that board who were part of the majority that fired the previous superintendent of the district. Where do we stand on the recall votes?
Yeah, right now, the votes in favor of recalling these two members, board members, are ahead by about 53%. You know, as you said, a group of parents started this recall effort shortly after the 2022 election, when these two board members and the rest of a conservative bloc on that school board abruptly fired the superintendent, who was well liked. You know, since then they have passed a flag policy, which many see as a veiled ban on flying the LGBTQ pride flag. They also passed a policy requiring teachers to notify parents if any student requests to go by a different name or gender other than that assigned at birth. You know, these are all kind of, they're big issues in school boards these days, in school districts. And, you know, a group of parents in Orange Unified decided that they wanted to try to stop this direction. And at least at the moment, it seems like they may be successful in recalling two of these members.
All right. And then we have the city of Huntington Beach with three measures, A, B, and C. Measure A, the first one, which is highly controversial because it would require voter ID, the question whether that even comports with the state constitution, but would require in Huntington Beach elections voter ID to be shown, and also that all ballot drop boxes would have full-time security. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so that's one that flipped from what we were seeing last night. And I think there's a good reason for that, which I'll talk about in a second. But yeah, so the yes votes for this voter ID measure are ahead right now, 54%. So this is not too surprising because the ballots that they have counted so far are all the in-person ballots. I mean, they've also counted ballots that were turned in and were able to be counted before the election, most of those ballots. But, you know, with this measure is sort of specifically targeted to people who are skeptical of election security and people concerned about voting fraud. That is the base voters of the conservative council members who put this voter ID measure on the ballot. And those conservative voters have largely voted in person for the past few election cycles. So it's not too surprising that that's where it stands right now. We will see if that holds. And then, of course, if that measure does pass, things are going to get very complicated in terms of, you know, whether the city can even implement this, whether they'll even try. They might, you know, get threats of lawsuits from the state. And, you know, they already have one lawsuit pending from a local citizen. And, you know, they may decide it's too expensive and they can't actually do it.
We also have Measure B, just real quickly, because we're tight on time. But, Jill, that would say the only flags that could fly on city property are the American flag and the POW/MIA flag. How is that trending?
Right. That one is also ahead right now, 58%. So that one's actually quite a wide margin right now.
All right, very good. And real quickly, the Irvine measure, which expands the council from 4 to 6 members and moves to district by district election instead of all of them up for the whole city's at-large votes.
Yeah, the yes votes on that are also ahead by quite a wide margin, about 59%.
All right. Jill, thank you so much. Jill Rep, local Orange County correspondent with us. Frank Stoltz, our civics and democracy correspondent, as we continue our coverage here on LAist 89.3. Coming up, we'll talk with the vice president of Political Data, Inc., which tracks early ballot return data. Paul Mitchell will be with us. And we'll also be talking with an expert on the whole voting access question, Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit that Kim refounded in 1994. We'll talk with them and take your calls about what you would like to see, if anything, changed about our election process here in California for the primary. We're at 866-893-5722 or email us at atcomments@las.com. Please include your location and first name. Back in 90 seconds.
Imagine if you could charge your electric vehicle at the places you already love to eat, shop, and play. Whether you're at the movies, on your weekly grocery trip, or running errands at your local mall, Volta EV charging stations are built around your day-to-day and located in your community and nationwide. All you have to do is check in, plug in, and go about your day. It's EV charging made convenient. Download the Volta app to find your new favorite place to charge.
Thank you.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking elections, Super Tuesday across the country, the California primary, and big, big races in Los Angeles and Orange counties. Pleased to have with us Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated. They track early ballot return data. They conduct polling and do a variety of research projects for campaigns, nonprofits, and institutions of higher education. Paul, thank you for being with us today.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's talk turnout. What does it appear this is going to land on compared to some of our past California primary turnouts?
So we're kind of expecting it to be around 30% turnout, and generally presidential primaries are at 47 to 50% turnout historically, but they're also the ones that fluctuate the most. Sometimes there'll be 70 or 75% turnout, and then sometimes we'll have elections like this, similar to what we had in 2012, when Democrats in 2012, just like this election cycle, didn't really have a primary because they had an incumbent president, Obama, at the time. And on the Republican side, the presidential primary was essentially decided already in 2012, with Romney having earned that nomination, just like in this election cycle. For all intents and purposes, Trump had already won the nomination before Tuesday. And similar to 2012, that was 31% turnout. So maybe something around 30% is what we should expect, given those dynamics of what drives turnout in these cases, that voter enthusiasm.
And we're going to likely have, the way things look, two comparatively unpopular candidates at the head of the ticket running for president. But with so many voters seeing this as a very high stakes election nonetheless, so looking at it, you know, from several months prior, what do you think we're apt to see for turnout in November?
Yeah, I think it would be a mistake to say, hey, we have really low turnout in March, so we're going to have low turnout in November. The fact is, like you said, that come November, most voters are going to feel like this might be the most important election of my lifetime. And there was virtually nobody outside of the candidates running themselves that probably thought that Tuesday was the most important election of their lifetime. I think the turnout will spike again. We'll get really full turnout in November. Not necessarily because voters are super thrilled about their own candidates, maybe. We've seen that in the polling. But because voters are very scared about the prospects on the other side. So they might not be thrilled to vote for Biden, but they're terrified of Trump. Or they might not be thrilled to vote for Trump, but they might be terrified of Biden. So that fear might drive voter turnout pretty high around the country.
Looking at the LA County DA's race and incumbent George Gascon trying to hold on with 11 challengers, it looks like Nathan Hochman is going to be the person who faces him in November. Your thoughts on this race and what we're able to parse to this point?
Yeah, so this was a really interesting race because clearly, you know, Gascon has been a polarizing figure. His popularity has been lower than when he first got elected, and he faced a serious challenge this cycle. But with all those candidates and with Nathan Hochman able to come out in the primary, and it looks like that will hold, even though we have a lot of outstanding ballots, this might be the best setup for George Gascon because it sets up a general election where it's a real kind of more traditional conservative, you know, candidate endorsed by a lot of Republicans, including Steve Cooley, the former DA, and against Gascon, who will probably consolidate a lot of the more progressive votes, even if some of those voters are concerned about the extent to which his progressive views pushed him in the first part of his first term.
You know, and it would seem the stakes are quite high for the criminal justice reform movement because if Hochman is able to defeat Gascon, even with the disadvantage of having, you know, formerly been a Republican in a Democratic county like Los Angeles, if Hochman could pull that off in November, that would seem to me an even bigger setback for Gascon than if one of the other candidates were to have defeated him.
Yeah, I think that it is a polarizing outcome in the primary. And by that, I mean that you have essentially candidates who are more at the ends of the political and policy spectrum that have come out of this primary. If the challenger had been somebody maybe who could appeal to more progressives and be a candidate they could you know, vote for and allow them to kind of move on from Gascon, but not move on from maybe the 60-70% of what Gascon believes in that they actually support, that could be a much more challenging election. If there was Gascon and Gascon light coming into the general election, you could see a very dynamic race. But what we're seeing here is really kind of two ends of the political spectrum coming into the general election.
We're talking with political researcher Paul Mitchell, Vice President of Political Data Incorporated. They're tracking early ballot return data and also consults with a wide range of redistricting committees and with candidates and institutions about political polling. I want to talk about a couple of the LA City Council races because, like the DA's race, the council district race in the 4th is really a progressive Nithya Raman, who's finishing a first term. She's going to be facing Ethan Weaver, who's running to the right of her. That's fascinating because you've got an ideological matchup there. But then you've also got, in the 14th district, a damaged candidate with a severely damaged image, Kevin De Leon, the incumbent, who's going to face either Miguel Santiago or Isabel Jurado in the November election. Different circumstances, but both of those are going to be fascinating to watch, Paul.
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, Nithya Raman is running in a newly redistricted seat, one where they didn't, in that redistricting, give her what she wanted, which was a district that was much more heavily renter. That will be a close race, I think, coming out in the general, just like it's close here in the primary. The 14th, I think, is an even more interesting race, given the fact that Kevin De Leon, 6 years ago, we were talking about Kevin De Leon as potentially the next U.S. senator when he challenged Dianne Feinstein. He was the pro tem of the state Senate in Sacramento, a real statewide political figure who had a, you know, really strong, a really big fall with those tapes and the things that were said on those tapes that were ostensibly about redistricting, but included a lot of, you know, racial and insensitive talk amongst different people that were in that meeting. And everybody in that meeting had essentially walked away from their job, whether it was as a labor leader or as a council member, except for Kevin De Leon, who held on and has essentially, I think, argued that this is a redemption arc for him, an ability for him to go back to the district that elected him, stop gallivanting around the rest of LA as a mayoral candidate or as a political figure of the state and be more a political figure in his community. And as a result, voters have rewarded him with the top spot in that city council race. Now, some people might read this election result right now as 30% roughly for Kevin De Leon and 70% for not Kevin De Leon.
Yeah.
And that will be a challenge going into the general election, as if Miguel Santiago, who's the likely second place candidate, can consolidate those votes.
Paul, thank you so much for walking us through some of these fascinating races that we're going to see in November and what unfolded in yesterday's election. We really appreciate your being with us and look forward to talking with you again.
Anytime. Thanks.
Thank you. From Political Data, Inc., Vice President Paul Mitchell with us. When we come back from a brief break, we'll be talking with Kim Alexander of the California Voter Foundation about some of the trends that we're seeing overall in voting, even with a comparatively low turnout California primary. So I want to let you know Proposition 1, which is that mega bond measure towards housing and services for people battling addiction or with mental health challenges, that is narrowly passing, but it's only 14,000 votes to the yes side. Who knows how that's going to wind up once all the votes are counted? That's still in flux. We'll continue in just 1 minute on Air Talk. Our continuing election coverage, which will extend into next hour here on Air Talk on LAist 89.3. It's my pleasure to welcome the president of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that was refounded in 1994 by our guest, Kim Alexander. Kim, thank you very much for joining us.
Hi, Larry. Great to be here.
We've seen a lot of changes in the whole voting process in California with an extension of the period to vote, the growth of ballot drop boxes, election counts that extend not just days, but can be into weeks before they're certified. You know, as you look at the effect on turnout and on access to voting, do you see these changes that we made being largely positive?
I have mixed feelings about these changes, to tell you the truth. I think they were made with the intention of making the process more inclusive, but on balance, I think that what's resulted is a lot of complexity and confusion. And I do worry that particularly for young Californians, the idea of voting by mail is not something that they are warm to. You know, it really depends on having a stable address. And a lot of younger people in California are housing unstable. So I think we have to make sure as we implement these changes that we're not leaving big chunks of our population behind.
Yeah, in fact, my son, who's in law school, had requested that LA County send his ballot to where he lives on campus. And instead, they sent it to our house. Fortunately, he came home in time to vote, but they didn't even, comply with the request. So I could see for students, for example, this could be particularly challenging to vote. I also wonder about enthusiasm. Now, obviously, if you've got a very high stakes election, that's going to pardon the expression, trump everything else. That's going to drive turnout. But yeah, if it's just sort of a typical election where people don't feel like the country's future is at stake, I wonder, with extending it out as long as the early voting period is, moving to vote centers instead of neighborhood precincts, whether this in some way diminishes the excitement around the process of voting.
I think it does take it away. I do know that a lot of the counties that have implemented vote centers have done a lot of work to make those sites very visible with flags and banners and to provide that kind of enthusiasm. But you know, it's not the same as a neighborhood polling place, and we've lost that ritual of doing this with your neighbors, which is something that a lot of people really cherished. And in a time when we don't have a lot of, civic education and engagement rituals left, it's sad to see that go. I do think there are ways we can recreate that spirit at voting sites, and I hope we'll do that in November. You know, I know that for a lot of people, they think, oh, voting is your duty. We need to do this. People who grew up in pro-voting households, you know, they're not going to question whether it's worth the time to vote. But somebody who did not have that experience, someone who maybe had parents saying it's a waste of time, you know, that's a lot of hurdles to overcome. And when you look at the ballot itself and see how complicated it is, how difficult these offices are to figure out, what does this person do? How do I evaluate whether they're making, would represent me well? It's very challenging for a lot of us, even those of us who are longtime voters. So I do think we need to do a better job helping Californians understand the context of the ballot, how these choices impact them directly, and why it's important to be a voter in terms of making sure that you and people who look like you represent an electoral threat to politicians. You know, politicians respond to the people who pose the biggest challenge to them in their future careers, and young people need to participate, if only for that reason. So I always tell young people, when it comes to voting, it's not a test. Just vote on the things you care about, but be a voter and skip the contests you're not sure about.
Yeah. Yeah, excellent advice, because, yeah, I think that is daunting for some people, feeling like they're supposed to do enough research to have an educated perspective on a wide range of things. And as you say, there's no obligation to vote for everything. Vote for things that are of greatest importance and that you feel you're knowledgeable about, and take that burden off of yourself. That makes sense. I think that, you know, the challenge is with younger voters, as it often is with even news consumption, is, you know, until you're looking at, you know, having your own kids, at potentially joining with someone else in a partnership, getting into your career, you know, in a more serious full-time level, until those things happen, I think the kinds of decisions you're making on a ballot can seem very distant. And of all the things competing for young people's time, I think it's hard to get an election,
unless it's something like, you know, a war and there's a draft or, you know, something that is right there in their face, it's hard to get participation.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And, you know, young people aren't stakeholders yet. They're not homeowners. Some of them may never even be able to become homeowners. And so they may not, you know, they don't have kids in public school. So, you know, those are a lot of barriers to overcome, but they do want to vote for president. I think it's important, you know, for your listeners, who I know are all voters and dedicated voters, I'm sure the people listening to this show, to think about people in your circle, maybe someone, a work colleague or someone's someone you know in your neighborhood who maybe hasn't had the benefit of voting and having an experienced voter in their family, and help them, you know, reach out to them and help them. And it really does take that personal engagement and somebody else leading the way and showing you how to do this, how to fill out your ballot properly, how to sign the ballot envelope, how to check your ballot was counted. You want
people
to
get information. Yeah.
Exactly. You want people to have a positive first-time experience when they vote, so they'll do it again.
Kim, that's wonderful advice to close out this hour. Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
President of the California Voter Foundation, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, Kim Alexander with us on Air Talk. We have much more election coverage to come in our second hour.
The LAist Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win. And the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So good to have you with us today, the day after Super Tuesday and the California primary. We spent last hour talking about the major returns from LA and Orange County, from statewide measures as well. I know some of you quite interested in that Long Beach measure, by the way, RW, which would increase the minimum wage for hotel workers in the city. That's too close to call. Very, very tight on that that ballot measure in Long Beach. We're going to spend the next half hour getting analysis of the results that we saw yesterday here in California, and then we're going to have some fun. We're taking the last half hour of today's show, taking a break from election. We're going to hear from listeners their favorite guilty pleasure of a film that's just, by all objective standards, truly bad, but just too delightful to miss watching. Something that you just love watching, but is just really, as artistry, a dud. That's coming up later this hour. But joining us to talk about election results from UCLA, Professor of Political Science and Chicana, Chicano, and Central American Studies, Matt Barreto. Professor, good to have you with us again.
Hey, Larry. Thanks for inviting me back.
So your thoughts just overall about the comparatively low turnout. I don't know what we're going to see in terms of the Latino electorate of California, but any surprise in what you actually saw take place at the polls?
Well, I do think low turnout is the trend. There did not appear to be here in California any major wow factor races that were out there, nothing that really got people out. If you look at the county series of California, it is the case that there were more Republican ballots cast for president in places like Orange County, San Bernardino, and Riverside. Those are the swing counties, and we're not talking about a lot, but these are counties that had been going about 53-47 Democrat in recent years, and at least in the primary last night, there were more Republican ballots cast in those sort of suburban counties. So it's true that on both sides of the aisle, there wasn't a huge turnout enthusiasm from either political party, and that's, you know, really going to have to change as we head towards November for some of these competitive congressional, of course, the U.S. Senate race, another contest here in California.
Given the poor showing in the primary by Katie Porter, Orange County Congress member, and Barbara Lee, Oakland area Congress member,
Your thoughts about, you know, was this largely because a few younger voters turned out because the base of support for those two candidates would be younger, more progressive voters? Or do you think just much of this really is the much cited Adam Schiff commercials in which he targeted Garvey as his opponent, not Porter?
I don't think the commercials had a huge impact. You know, we're in a new political era today where the traditional over-the-airwaves TV commercials and the commercials you might see on Facebook, they don't have nearly as much impact as they used to because we have such a diffuse and dispersed out media environment where people get information. So I know that was a talking point, but I don't see a lot of impact of those ads. I think Adam Schiff is, you know, he's got 24 years in Congress. He was the head of the impeachment. He was on the Jan 6 committee, and he's got a lot of name recognition. He's been fighting Trump, and he's a well-known Democrat, not just here in Southern California, but up and down the state. So I think that was a significant advantage for him. And yes, as you mentioned, youth turnout very low. It's not uncommon in primary elections, and that was going to need to change for folks like Porter and Lee. But Porter and Lee were also both sort of splitting a little bit of the more progressive vote. And so it didn't seem like there just was quite enough in there with those three Democrats in the race, congressional members in the race, to be able to see two go to the top two. So we have something different now. Yeah. We finally have a Republican back on the November ballot here in California for U.S. Senate. We haven't had that for a while.
Well, and, you know, as we had talked about earlier, that's such a wealthy district that Schiff represents. He's been such a formidable fundraiser, not just for himself, but other members of the House. He's a real rainmaker. So nothing better to have that skill and be able to tap into a district like that and fund his campaign, successful to this point of getting to the November runoff. I have to say, I was surprised. If you even look at the combined total of Porter and Lee, that progressive vote among Democrats, you're still only about a quarter of the vote.
Yeah, not enough to get into second place, certainly. And so that marks a change, as we said. You know, we had seen a number of U.S. Senate races here in California with two Democrats advancing to the November runoff. And so that marks a change. And I think it's a turnout story. I don't think it's an ideology story. I don't think it means that progressive base is not still here. In California, it is. But there just wasn't enough enthusiasm to bring folks out for an otherwise lackluster primary election in California. Certainly there's some local races and measures that are going to be interesting, but overall, I don't think anyone is worried, and no one should be worried, that Adam Schiff is going to lose the U.S. Senate race. So there was no urgency, I think, on the Democratic side, nor really even on the Republican side, to see a big turnout in a primary election.
We're talking with Matt Barreto, UCLA professor, political scientist by specialty. Also joining us, Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the John Randolph Haines and Dora Haines Foundation, a private nonprofit organization supporting social science. Rafe, so good to have you with us. I'm curious your thoughts on the DA's race in Los Angeles County and Nathan Hochman, former Republican, being the one, it appears at this point, to face off against incumbent George Gascón.
Yeah, these results continue to be unsettling for George Gascón. He's, you know, he's around the low 20s. He's obviously going to get into the runoff. But the number two and three candidates both ran against him kind of from the more conservative side. And it's an indicator that the primary has been kind of an ebb time for progressive voting blocks. And I think it shows up here, but also in San Francisco on a ballot measure there. I agree with Matt that a lot of this changes in November. This primary system we have now doesn't really play well for the Democratic progressive base, whereas November does. But Gascón's got a long way to go to get to a majority in November. His polling has lagged. He's never really quite recovered from the first months of his period as district attorney. It's kind of striking. It's now years later, but he's still trying to, you know, get back from sort of some fairly rigid positions he took at the start that he had to kind of moderate. He's got a tough race.
14th LA City Council District race, where Kevin De Leon, battered, banged up by the self-inflicted wounds on that surreptitiously recorded tape of the LA County Federation of Labor, in which he and two other council members made racist and disparaging comments. He gets just over a quarter of the vote. It appears Miguel Santiago, with huge labor backing, or potentially Isabel Jurado, face him in the November runoff. He's obviously got the name recognition, but in this case, that's bad as well as good.
Well, you know, that's a reminder that all politics is local, and then it's local within local. There's 15 council districts. You've got two council members, incumbents, who are in trouble citywide. You've got John Lee in the 12th district, you know, who's facing charges from the Ethics Commission, and Kevin De Leon, who's been all over the news with his problems. But voters in the individual districts can kind of go against that grain and still vote for people that they know, who they're familiar with, who they think are, you know, attentive to their district. Now, that's more true for Lee, who seems to be coasting to victory. Kevin De Leon still has a tough road to go. But would any of us predict a year ago that Kevin De Leon would be finishing first in a primary with at least two strong Democratic state legislators in the race? I think he'll have a tough runoff, but again, district politics sometimes overtake citywide politics.
Rafe Sonnenschein with us of the John Randolph and Dora Haynes Foundation. Also with us, Mindy Romero, USC political sociologist and director of the Center for Inclusive Democracy at SC. Mindy, it's so good to have you with us again. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So I want to ask you about these LA City Council races. Another one, in addition to De Leon trying to hang on by his fingernails in the 14th, we have the race for the 4th district, where Nithya Raman, the incumbent, had her district totally realigned and much of it now in the San Fernando Valley. She's just a couple of points ahead of challenger Ethan Weaver. Your thoughts about this and the progressivism of Raman that is being challenged in this race? Mindy, are you there? We just lost Mindy Romero. We will try and get her back on. Rafe, your thoughts about the 4th district race and Raman and Weaver's matchup?
Well, this is a reminder that this race, the turnout still has a long way to go, and that's a race where the incumbent Raman is almost at 50%, but so is her main opponent. Weaver is almost at 50%. So one of them, actually, when all the returns come in, might get a majority. And if that does happen, I would bet on the incumbent, Raman, since I think younger voters will be coming in later on. It's a continuation of this year's sort of challenge between progressive Democrats in City Hall and center-left Democrats. I mean, everybody's running pretty much as Democrats, but she's being challenged from the center on homelessness and policing and issues like that. So this ebb and flow of progressive politics that we've talked about from the start is definitely playing out in that race. I still think she'd be favored, but there's no way to know how these later votes are going to go.
Professor Barreto, your thoughts on the 4th district.
Rafe is right about that. And by the way, great to be on with you, Rafe, and talk politics. I think what you're seeing is, you know, whether or not the progressive energy, which is definitely there in pockets of the city of LA, is going to be able to make issue-based arguments, district and issue-based arguments, not these broad sort of Bernie Sanders generalizations, which some of these candidates started with, and that where there was a lot of momentum there. But they need to be district-based and issue-based arguments, and I think you'll see that return in November. You have to remember, the November election is going to be cast for all of us as the scariest election of our lives, with a very conservative and extreme candidate for president making all sorts of scary sounding statements. So that should give the progressive movement, I think, a little bit of boost in energy. And you'll see that play out, I think, in some of these local contests as well. But they need to connect it to the local issues.
How much, though, is that tempered by the fact that younger voters see Joe Biden as very old, as infirm? You know, they're by and large going to get behind the idea that Trump is a menace. But is there a, you know, people I know can be motivated by fear, but also it helps them to be motivated by someone they're attracted to. And younger voters do not appear to be attracted to Joe Biden. So, Matt, how does that factor in?
Well, I think we heard the same thing. The first thing is we heard the same thing in 2020. You can go back, and I've been looking at a lot of the coverage, you know, right before the pandemic broke out. And you saw the same things that, you know, people were not younger, progressive people didn't know where they stood with respect to Biden, that his sort of day had passed and he was older. But by the time the general election came around, that had waned and people were excited. They were excited about the choices. And we saw robust turnout, including among young people in 2020. So I think we're in a similar moment where it's early. Yes, there's frustration, but people are going to come, I would say, back to where they were when the choice is clear, when there's contrast messaging. You're going to see heavy, heavy contrast messaging after the conventions this summer. And that entire fall is just, we're going to be inundated with choice. What choice are you going to make? Which choice do you want for the future of our country? Now, we don't have a competitive presidential here, but that will filter down to our U.S. congressional races and even possibly, and I think this is where Rafe was going, into some of the city council contests if it is about progressive versus mainstream Democrats.
Matt Barreto of UCLA, political scientist with us, Rafe Sonnenschein of the John Randolph Haines and Dora Haines Foundation. Rafe, you agree with Matt?
Yeah, and I'd add something else. An unenthusiastic vote counts exactly the same as an enthusiastic vote. And the other thing is most candidates for office in this country are not John Kennedy, Barack Obama, and Ronald Reagan. They are ordinary looking people who you're not crazy about, but they become a vehicle for what you want to accomplish as a voter. And I think that Biden is going to present himself not as vote for me because I'm such a wonderful, delightful person, but because I am the vehicle to accomplish what you need to accomplish as a voter. And I think we just massively overstate turning politicians into movie stars that people are crazy about. I think the voters are actually quite a bit smarter than that.
We're talking with Rafe Sonnenschein and Matt Barreto. Unfortunately, we lost Mindy Romero of USC and are having trouble getting her back on the line. But if we're able to reconnect, we'll bring her back into the conversation. You're listening to Air Talk on LAist 89.3. We have more conversation on the election results yesterday. And if you have questions for our experts about what we've seen in the results so far, again, we have few weeks to go before they're actually official and a done deal. But if you have questions about where we are now, we're at 866-893-5722. Back in a minute. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us as we're talking the results of yesterday's California primary, LA and Orange County local races, and what's happened, of course, Super Tuesday nationally. In case you just woke up in the past hour or so, Nikki Haley suspended her presidential campaign, and Mitch McConnell, who is the outgoing leader of Republicans in the Senate, has endorsed former President Trump's candidacy. The two men, it's believed, haven't spoken in several years and were anything but fast friends. But McConnell falling in line with his fellow senators in Republican senators in endorsing the former president. I did want to talk about a couple of key Senate races. Key House races. One of them involving Katie Porter, who ran for the Senate, so gave up her coastal Orange County 47th district seat. Their Republican Scott Baugh was the top vote getter, at least to this point of the count, with 33%, and Democratic legislator Dave Minn with 25%, Democrat Joanna Weiss with 19%. I'm just curious, Rafe, your thoughts on this race. It's been held by a Democrat, but it is in Orange County, which overall is still a bit purple. Do you think that Baugh, the Republican, could end up winning this seat?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a toss-up race. And I think one of the problems for the Democrats of Katie Porter giving up her seat is it wasn't that this was a Democratic seat. This was a Katie Porter seat. She was the Democrat who had picked the lock on this district. Now, Waugh is a very flawed candidate who's had problems of his own. And Dave Min, if he's likely the Democrat in the race, has his own problems. I think this is very worrisome for Democrats, the possibility of losing this seat. But I think they can win it, they can lose it. I think it's very much in play.
The 40th district, which Adam Schiff had represented, that very lucrative fundraising district centered on Burbank, Los Feliz, Glendale, a little slice of Pasadena. Laura Friedman, the state legislator, tops, followed by Republican Alex Balikian, Anthony Portantino, another state legislator, longtime one from La Cañada with 14%. Mike Feuer, former L.A. City council member and former L.A. City attorney, slightly trailing that. Rafe, your thoughts about the 40th. This is a safe Democratic seat, but it looks like that Friedman might well be facing a Republican here, which I'm assuming is essentially a slam dunk for her.
Maybe a slam dunk. I think it's very good for the Democrats to have run against a Republican there. But what really shaped this race was an incredible array of strong Democratic candidates who ran. So it was actually kind of hard. I mean, she's going to finish first in the 20s, in the high 20s. So again, it was a tribute to the fact that this is a very significant district, very active district, a lot of active voters and people attentive to campaigns. But having three really strong Democrats in this race really meant that it was unlikely that two of them were going to make the runoff.
Looking at the L.A. County Board of Supervisor races, Holly Mitchell cruised with almost two-thirds of the vote. Janice Hahn is still over 50%, so she could win outright in this election. But former L.A. County Sheriff Alex Villanueva challenged her. And I'm curious, Matt Barreto, your thoughts about this. I mean, it still shows that Villanueva has some support.
Yeah, you know, I think we were talking about this when he first ran for sheriff the first time, right? He kind of surprised folks and ran as a Latino candidate, trying to get his name out in Latino neighborhoods. And he still has a little bit of that name recognition. And I was looking over the results. I was surprised by that. I think Hahn's going to hold on and stay over 50. But there is still name recognition there. Certainly faced a lot of scandals and leadership crises. But he's, you know, politicians don't ever give up on that name recognition, I think. And I wouldn't be surprised to see him continue in L.A. politics somewhere.
And Rafe, Catherine Barger cruising in the 5th district, even with Chris Holden, longtime state legislator who, you know, running very much as a Democrat in this nonpartisan seat. Barger is a moderate Republican. But Barger getting Planned Parenthood and union support, I mean, that's so interesting. It wasn't Holden whose, you know, political career has been so heavily supported by unions. It was Barger, was the incumbent, who got that.
Well, first of all, she's a real object lesson to Republican candidates in California. She was running against a strong, well-known Democrat, strongest challenge she has faced, but she really runs as an old-fashioned moderate Republican, progressive on enough issues to be really acceptable to Democratic voters in the district. Democrats outnumber Republicans by quite a bit there, actually almost the same as statewide numbers. But incumbency, a vast district, a district that takes up basically half the land area of LA County, but they know their supervisor. They don't always know who's in government locally, but the supervisor is almost like the mayor of these big unincorporated territories and smaller cities. So local matters, nonpartisan matters, and a Republican candidate who doesn't run as a modern Republican, as we are seeing kind of in the Trump orbit, does very well and survives and thrives.
And my sense, this is just anecdotal, I have no data to back this up, but my sense is that she's been perceived by many of her constituents as offering strong constituent services, which is part of what county supervisors are supposed to do. And Matt Barreto, I'm curious your thoughts. I mean, does that carry political credit when you've got offices that have good reputations for responding to constituents?
Yes, certainly. And I think Rafe described it well. I mean, this part of Northern LA County is vast. There's not huge cities there. And so it is oftentimes the LA County supervisor who comes in and provides those services and has high name recognition. You'll see a lot of signs They go to a lot of ribbon cuttings. They're really present because there isn't the city government to fall back on in places like the Antelope Valley and other rural sort of mountainous areas of northern LA. So the supervisor has an important role. We always think about that in here in the city of LA because we have the city government, we have the mayor, et cetera. But that is really the role of local county supervisors, is to make sure that these unincorporated or smaller town areas don't get forced out and that they get their piece of the pie of LA County, the single largest county in America. So I think Rafe's read on that is right, and I would expect that kind of candidate to continue being successful in that part of LA.
And Matt, just before I let you go, I want to get your thoughts on California's Proposition 1, the mega bond measure for providing housing as well as supportive services for those living on the streets, dealing with mental illness and with addiction. This started off looking like it was going to be fairly easy passage, tightened up in polling, and it looks like it's a total toss-up at this point. It's got 14,000 more yes votes in the state, but that's given the size of the electorate in California. That's a very, very thin margin. Is this what you expected?
Not what I expected, but given the state of the economy and people's concerns about spending, I think it's natural that people are not quite ready for, you know, very large bond measures. As you said, 14,000 votes. We're going to have to wait and see what the late counted, but on-time arriving absentee ballots tell us there's tons of more, you know, thousands and thousands of more absentee ballots out there that are going to be counted. And it's less than half a percentage point right now, as you said, 14,000 ballots, super close. But we have to remember that there are still concerns about costs. California has been a very generous state on providing services. But now may not be the right time in some people's minds to make additional expenditures, no matter how important this mental health treatment on measure was.
And there also is the jurisdictional issue, because it does, in addition to issuing the bond, it would take the money raised from the so-called millionaire state tax, and that would be redirected from counties to the state of California. There were, among some of the opponents, concerns about the state taking over all that. But I want to thank both of our guests this hour so much for their analysis. UCLA Professor of Political Science and Chicano, and Central American Studies, Matt Barreto. And our thanks to Rafe Sonnenschein, Executive Director of the John Randolph Haines and Dora Haines Foundation, nonprofit organization supporting social science. It's Air Talk on LAist 89.3. So that's enough now for the election. We just spent an hour and a half on all these different races and measures. Let's have some fun. I want to hear from you. What is a film that you understand is really dreadful, but you just can't help watching? It's a pleasure to you, even though the film is a wreck. Or maybe it is the fact that the movie is a wreck is what makes it just so enjoyable, sometimes jaw-droppingly so. We're at 866-893-5722. I'd like your contribution to movies that are so bad they're entertaining. 866-893-5722. Or email your contribution to this conversation at atcomments@laist.com. Please include your location and first name. I'll be back with our Film Week critic, Christy Lemire. She'll weigh in with her choices and respond to yours. But I need to hear from you now. 866-893-5722. Back in 90 seconds.
Hey, it's Brian, the host of How to LA, a podcast that is a love letter to Los Angeles. Independent movie theaters are having a glow-up moment.
Vidiot's and Eagle Rock, amazing. We have our friends at the American Cinematheque. The Vista just reopened.
In our new series, Revival House, we'll take you inside these spots and share their history. Because movie history is LA history. Listen to Revival House on How to LA wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Movies so bad, they are absolutely riveting. Can't take your eyes off the disaster that sits in front of you on your
home television screen or watching it in a movie theater. You know, some of these movies have become ritualistic group watches at movie theaters, midnight or late night screening. So I want to hear from you. What is a film that's so bad that it's just absolutely wonderful? We're at 866-893-5722. That's 866-893-5722. I'm so glad to be joined by our terrific Film Week critic, Christy Lemire, who was just with all of us on the stage Sunday afternoon at the Orpheum Theater for our annual Oscar preview, which you'll be able to hear, by the way, Friday morning at 10 and Saturday morning at noon here on LAist 89.3. Christy, so good to have you with us today.
I am so delighted to be here, Larry. I love this topic so much. So you have asked the right person.
So let me hear some of your favorites. Just start listing them off and why you think that they're just must-watches despite being disasters artistically.
Well, the first one I always go to is Xanadu. My first thought always, and I love it totally unironically. We have a series on our Breakfast All Day YouTube channel called Was It Great or Were You Eight? And we look back at movies we love from our childhood and try to figure out, like, are they good really? Or do we just love them through nostalgia? And my first pick was Xanadu, because when you're a kid, like, Olivia Newton-John is so pretty and she can roller skate and sing at the same time and she seems so nice. But Xanadu was notoriously a flop, I considered really terrible. But looking back at as an adult, there are charms that, you know, maybe we missed back then, as far as it's Gene Kelly's final role and some of the choreography is fun and the ELO songs are great. So I think any movie that puts itself out there and does something daring and different and fails, to me, is much more exciting than playing it safe. We review so many movies every year as film critics, and most of them fall in that 2 to 2.5 star realm. Like, I'd rather have a really interesting flop. I'd rather have a movie that gets an F cinema score. You know, like, to me, I'm like, ooh, sign me up for that. How soon can I see that? I also love Grease 2. A lot of these that get trashed are often musicals. They go for it. And Grease 2 came on the heels of Grease, and that was a cultural phenomenon. Nothing could ever possibly match up to that. But those songs are catchy. I stand by Grease 2. you mentioned some communal experiences like The Room. The Room is a really interesting choice because Tommy Wiseau is just an oddball, singular figure. And this thing became like a Rocky Horror thing where people would go and, you know, yell lines at the screen and throw plastic spoons, and it's become a communal thing. And that's part of the fun with these so bad they're good movies, is to experience them in a crowd and feel that big cathartic laughter. There's just pure joy in that.
Oh, it's great. Well, this is our listeners' chance to vote. You're coming off Election Day. Your pick for the most entertaining bad movie, one that you just, streaming choices, you want to go for it and see it because it's just too entertaining to miss. 866-893-5722. Terry, in Studio City, you have one that I know Christy is a fan of, but I certainly am. Terry, what's your pick?
Showgirls, hands down.
Showgirls.
Stands up. Elizabeth Berkley, Dina Gershon, classic line, don't get pissed off, it makes you look older. So my hands down favorite.
It's so captivating, Christy, is the only way I know how to express it. And I like Gina Gershon as an actor, and but the film is just, it's like, what was he thinking when he made this?
Well, it's so lurid, right? And in its time, it was considered so shocking. I actually saw Showgirls with my husband as an early date. And like 26 years later, we're still married. So Showgirls couldn't ruin our marriage. Yeah. But I think with Showgirls, you know, the wisdom has kind of turned on that over the years. There's a whole documentary called You Don't Know Me, NOMI for Nomi Malone, which really reinvestigates what Showgirls means as a statement on the way that women get exploited in entertainment and feminism. And it's got a lot more in its mind than just how titillating it is. So I think like that with like Ishtar as well, conventional wisdom has evolved over the years.
Isn't that, that's fascinating. The other thing I'd say about Elizabeth Berkley's starring role in that film is she really threw herself into that. She didn't hold back. And, you know, when we have actors like Emma Stone who do that, and, you know, we praise them for that. She did not get credit for, even though the film was a flop, the total commitment that she brought to the character.
Yeah, it's emotionally and very much physically, it's daring for sure.
Let's see. Let's talk with Steve in Culver City, your film that's so bad it's entertaining. Steve, are you there?
Yeah. I love Anaconda.
Anaconda. Is that with the CG rendered giant snake?
Yeah, what a cast. John Boyd, Jennifer Lopez, Owen Wilson, Eric Stoltz. What a disaster.
Anaconda Christie.
Jennifer Lopez is acting in this. She does so many bland romantic comedies in which she makes weird choices like This or The Cell. I applaud her for that.
Hannah in Monrovia said, a movie, Manos, The Hands of Fate, hard to imagine a worse film. I wouldn't go out of my way to watch it, but it's fun to watch other people writhe in agony watching it for the first time, so it's fun in that way. Manos, The Hands of Fate. Kate in Hollywood, my favorite bad movie is Valley Girl with Nicolas Cage. I held on to my VHS copy for years because there wasn't a DVD copy. I didn't transfer over to purchasing DVDs until the aughts when Valley Girl was finally released on that format. That's Kate in Hollywood. I hadn't thought of that as a movie that's so bad it's entertaining. Where, how would you put that one, Christy?
Valley Girl is very important. I grew up in Woodland Hills in the 80s. I love Valley Girl. There's nothing wrong with it.
It's your life.
The mall. It is totally like a documentary for me. That and Fast Times at Ridgemont High. No, but I do feel like that's a legitimately good movie. And, you know, the early glimmers of Nick Cage, before he was crazy Nick Cage, there's a romantic kind of sweetness to him here. So I think that's a legitimately good one.
Alex in Long Beach says, Hudson Hawk with Bruce Willis. I couldn't stop laughing at it. I never miss it when it's on. Let's talk with Brian in Irvine. Brian, your most compelling bad film.
Okay, so it's kind of a two-parter-ish, but the biggest one is called Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter. It is the most adorable schlock that ever has come out of, like, Toronto or Quebec. It was the whole thing had a budget of, like, $5,000, and between Jesus fighting the atheist clown car via kung fu and the musical number in the middle and the Mexican luchador El Santo coming in to help save the day at the end, you can't go wrong with something this bad. Like, MST3K can't touch this.
Wow. Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter. Have you heard, Christy, of that one?
I have not, but I can't wait to watch it now.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to ask how long the running time on that one. 866-893-5722. Kelsey in North Hollywood, your favorite bad movie.
Hi, Larry.
Hi.
Thanks for having me.
You
Thanks
bet.
For taking my call. Right when you said that, the first movie that came to mind was Twilight.
Twilight?
The first Twilight, because I think it's a masterpiece, and I have to give credit to my sister because she read the books when we were teenagers, and I could never see the mastery in it. And then as I got older, I started to appreciate how you could really see what the teen angst and what all the kids were going through, and it was kind of silly. And then seeing people act on TikTok made me laugh too, you know. So I think that it really like broke down some of my barriers, and I was able to really appreciate it. But I cringe when I watch it.
All right, Kelsey. Twilight. Christy Lemire, our Film Week critic, is with us. And we're taking your calls. what film is just objectively bad by almost every measure, but you can't help but watch it and enjoy the film nonetheless? 866-893-5722. Nikki in Redlands emailed us, "Guilty pleasure movie is My New Gun with Diane Lane, Stephen Collins, and James LaGrosse. It came out in 1992 when I was 10 years old. Someone gave my family the VHS tape. I wore it out watching it repeatedly. It's akin to watching YouTube shorts for tweens nowadays." That's Nikki in Redlands. Anne in San Francisco wrote, "Great bad films. I originally saw Con Air because of the excellent cast. It was so ridiculous. I saw it again years later, and if seen as a comedy, it is hilarious. Con Air." That's Anne in San Francisco. Gina from South Pasadena, "Worst movie I actually love is Bad Santa. The lunch break scene is hilarious." I think Bad Santa is a terrific movie, Christy.
The first Bad Santa is really good. Yeah,
I like
we didn't
it.
Have the whole proliferation of like Bad Grandpa, Bad Teacher. We didn't have so many of those. Bad Santa was still pretty groundbreaking and very funny.
Carmen in El Sereno emailed, "She-Devil, starring Roseanne Barr and Meryl Streep, one of my favorite guilty pleasures. I make sure to watch it with the curtains drawn. I still randomly conjure up quotes from it. I'm laughing just thinking about it now. She-Devil from 1989. Christy, you remember that one?
I do, kind of vaguely. I actually have more thoughts on Con Air and how Nicolas Cage keeps coming up in all of these, because yes. Nicolas Cage takes chances and he makes choices. One of the movies that he did was that remake of The Wicker Man, and that comes up every single time anyone puts together any kind of list of the best, worst movies ever. And I think there's just such an intensity and a wiliness to his screen persona that he's so aware of and he seizes on, and that's exciting.
Let's take another listener call. This is from Mike in Pasadena. Your favorite bad film?
Hi, Hilarious. Appreciate you guys. Yeah,
thanks.
Troll 2. And this might be sort of another level than some of the other films that have been discussed. And not to be confused or, you know, as being related to Troll 1, which had Julia Louis-Dreyfus in it, and was actually a great film. This Italian film director, Claudio Fragasso, kind of had this situation going where he also made Terminator 2 before Terminator 2 came out, just to be released in Italy. So he was kind of taking these intellectual properties and making sequels of them. But for Troll 2, he went to Utah and picked up some community actors that had problems with his take on English and how people would say things in English. And the movie is just a complete disaster, but so watchable, to the extent that there's been midnight showings at Newark. There's a documentary on it by one of the children actors called Best Worst Movie. It is just so enjoyable and so wonderful.
Troll 2, I've got to watch it. Have you seen it, Christy?
I have, and I've also seen Best Worst Movie because Michael Paul Stevenson, who was in it, who directed it, was a fellow dad at my son's preschool. It's such an LA thing. So I've seen Best Worst Movie, and I appreciate, like, you know, reveling in the cheesiness. It's good.
Charlie in Monrovia says, "I love Nacho Libre with Jack Black. Nothing bad about it. My kids and I just have memorized every line in the film." Robin Mid-Wilshire says, "The John Waters movie, Pink Flamingos. I saw it when it came out in D.C. I left the film halfway in due to getting ill and the projector burning, so the viewing was delayed." That, of course, is a true cult film, one of those midnight movies, Pink Flamingos, starring Divine, one of the nicest people I've ever met, interviewed the late Divine years ago, who appeared in a number of John Waters films. That a very influential movie, by the way, Christy, Pink Flamingos.
Yeah, I think all of John Waters, like, that's an ethos. That's a choice. And he's going for that, whereas a lot of movies are bad, but they don't set out to be bad.
Let's talk with Mike in Beverly Hills. Mike, what terrible film do you find incredibly watchable? Mike, are you there?
Yes, I am. Thank you. I actually co-wrote the sequel to Anacondas and was an electrician on Valley Girl, so
wow.
I'm familiar with some
that's
of the
great.
My favorite guilty pleasure is Zardoz, the John Borman film he made after Deliverance, in which Sean Connery is running around in a red diaper. And I saw it under the influence of a powerful hallucinogen and thought it was the best film that had ever been made.
Zardoz. I just remember the radio ads for that Zardoz that they play incessantly on the radio. I never saw the film. Christy, did you see Zardoz?
Oh, have I seen Zardoz? I've written about Zardoz.
Oh my God.
And it, to me, it's the same kind of movie as like Logan's Run. You know, it's so 70s. It's this idea of the future, but with a 70s aesthetic and just incredibly cheesy costume and production designs. Like their idea of the future looks so dated now, but it's so luxurious. I love it.
All right. We're going to have more of our listener picks for the most entertaining bad films ever made. Christy Lemire joins us, our Film Week critic. You can also read her writing on film at RogerEbert.com and her Saturday matinee newsletters at ChristyLemire.com. And she co-hosts the Breakfast All Day YouTube channel and podcast. A very, very busy critic and writer. Christy Lemire continues with us. We'll be back on Air Talk in a minute. I'm going to be off tomorrow. Austin Cross will be sitting in for me. And thank you so much for joining us. All our election coverage, which we remind you continues at LAist.com/results. You have a chance to see all of the election returns at as well as analysis at LAist.com. We're asking about your favorite bad movies. Michael in Silver Lake has one that's one of my favorites. And my wife, Kristen, walked out of the room in shock that I was actually watching this on TV a couple of years ago. It's from my childhood, from 1958, but it played on TV in the 60s a lot. The Crawling Eye with Forrest Tucker. You can literally see the wires holding up this giant eye. Michael, thank you for reminding me of The Crawling Eye. It's absolutely one must watch. Another one of those old horror films is The Maze, which is a movie about the family member who is kept up in the attic, who actually is a giant frog. I'm sorry for the spoiler, who then actually breaks out of the castle, this person in a giant frog suit, and starts hopping around the grounds. 866-893-5722. Jeffrey in Beverly Hills, your favorite bad film.
Yes, The Reigns of Ranchipur, 1955, is the perfect example of an old Hollywood film which tries to enhance a tired cliché with epic scope and glamour. It was right for one critic to characterize it as the story of, quote, a woman redeemed by the removal of her makeup. The woman in question being beautiful Lana Turner as a jaded, titled lady in India who finds a new purpose in an otherwise aimless life by volunteering as a nurse in a cholera epidemic, eventually contracting and dying of the epidemic without her makeup.
Oh, my gosh, Jeffrey. Thank you for that. The Reigns of Ranchipur, did you say? All right. Thank you so much. We have Paul in Burbank, who writes, Big Ass Spider from 2013. After I watched it, I told my friends, I bet the budget was over $50,000. It's set in L.A., which makes it even more fun. Linda in Alhambra emailed, The Sandpiper with Liz Taylor and Richard Burton, tropes galore. Dylan in Tahunga emailed Street Fighter from 1994 starring Jean-Claude Van Damme. Very poorly written, a terrible representation of the video game, but Van Damme and Raul Julia totally ham up their performances, have some very memorable quotes that I still think of to this day. Dylan, thank you so much. Eric in North Hollywood emailed, I forced my college roommates to watch 1941 and Under the Rainbow, two of my all-time favorite bad movies. I lost all movie selection privileges until I convinced them to watch Reservoir Dogs and was redeemed. That's Eric in North Hollywood. These are great. Jack in Eagle Rock, my guilty pleasure is Absolute Beginners, another musical. They hired pop stars and had them write their own songs for their characters. David Bowie at his schlockiest. That's Jack in Eagle Rock. Nick in Hollywood emailed, Amazon Women on the Moon, absolute ridiculous film, can't resist it. Christy?
Yeah, I remember that very well from my teenage years. That and Kentucky Fried Movie are movies that I don't know that you could make today because they're these like episodic little sketches and they're so raunchy and so inappropriate. Larry, when you mentioned The Crawling Eye, which I have never seen but want to, and you mentioned that you could see the wires, it made me think of like every Ed Wood movie.
Yeah.
It made me think of Plan 9 from Outer Space and how irresistible those are. You know, he was so earnest in making these movies and they were so terrible, and that's part of their charm.
Doug in Los Feliz, Cats is just a huge confusing. How did this get made frolic? But I love dance numbers and characters of unusual size. The rowdy screenings at Alamo Drafthouse were always fun. That's Doug in Los Feliz. Belen in West Covina says, to Wong Fu, thanks for everything. Julie Newmar, so campy, not the most accurate portrayal of drag queens, but so much fun to watch. Richard in Pasadena, the movie Dark Star was a student film from then up-and-coming director John Carpenter. Super high-quality visual effects and the likes of Dan O'Bannon, who also was in the movie. Horrible, super cheesy science fiction movie. I lent a copy on VHS to a friend. The next day, his wife asked if I was mad at them. Maxim in Redondo Beach, I second Anaconda and also Sharknado. We used to organize watch parties for it, even better or worse with beer. Tom in Ojai also says one word, Zardoz. Chris in Larchmont Village, Killer Clowns from Outer Space. What else can be said? Danny in Echo Park, real quickly, almost out of time, your pick for worst film that's a hoot to watch.
One of the greatest nights of my life was at the Egyptian. It was sold out to see The Apple, a biblical allegory of the Adam and Eve story set in the future, made by Canon Films. And there's Chris Nichols handing out BIM Mark stickers. That was a feature in the movie to demonstrate how cool you were. And people in the audience were putting these triangle stickers on their faces in the theater. It was so fun. The Apple is the worst.
The Apple, Danny, thanks so much. Kim in Glendora says, The Core. There's a scene where the shuttle re-enters the atmosphere, hits downtown LA, creating a sonic boom, and then landing in the LA River. Just awful and good. And Dan in Brentwood says, Midnight Madness, a scavenger hunt movie that was tremendous. Played on HBO all the time when I was a kid in the 80s. Dan, thank you for that. Christy, this has been so much fun and a nice antidote to all the serious stuff in the world right now. Thank you for joining us for this.
My pleasure. So fun. Great choices.
Thank you. Thank you for being with us for another Air Talk on LAist 89.3, Austin Cross in tomorrow as well as Friday, hosting Air Talk. And of course, Film Week Friday at 10 and Saturday at noon. It's our Oscar preview show. Have a great rest of the day.